Hey there.
Good morning, Glenn.
John McWhorter, how you doing, my man?
I am pretty good, pretty good.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a little too long.
Since we've talked.
I just got back from the big Linguistics Society of America shindig down in Baltimore. And while that was wrapping up on Saturday, we got another one of these big race stories, and this one actually had to do with language, and I think you know which one I mean.
Oh, you're talking about the Harry Reid brouhaha.
Yes, I had to write a piece on it for the New Republic in my hotel room.
You and had to write a piece for the New Republic. There was no option.
Well, one must. So I did.
And all right, then. So what are the smart people at the New Republic, yourself, saying about this issue? I need to know what to think.
Well, you know, I don't know what the other ones are thinking, but I know that what I'm thinking is that a lot of it seems to just hinge on the use of that particular word Negro and its rather unique resonances as late as 2010. But to the extent that the whole thing has given rise to a certain sub-chorus of people saying that there's no such thing as a distinctly black American way of talking, I wanted to ward that off because, as we all know intuitively, as we all know deep down, if we pretend that this isn't true, we're resisting our inner impulses, which sometimes can be the right thing. But as we all know, there is a black English. And so we can't start from pretending that Harry Reid is essentializing or that he's a racist for thinking there's a black way of talking. So I started with that notion. You get that, don't you, that there's a such thing as black speech?
Well, I think not only from experience would I say that there's a black dialect, and you have Ward Connerly, I don't know if you saw it in the Wall Street Journal this morning with an op-ed piece. This is the conservative Republican African-American from California.
I haven't gotten to that page today.
He's an outspoken activist against affirmative action over the years, and he has an op-ed basically saying, the brouhaha about the word Negro is extraordinary in view of the fact that many people, particularly of his generation, still regard the word as perfectly kosher.
Mm-hmm.
And he's also making some points about comparing to the Trent Lott incident, you know, all of this Senate people misspeaking by saying offensive things to African Americans and so on. So, but you think it's a tempest in a teapot, do you?
Perfectly absurd. I mean, for one thing, it was called Negro dialect by scholars until roughly 1970, when the word Negro was okay. And really, it's just a matter of Reid having groped for a vaguely scholarly or formal way of putting it. And it wasn't the most graceful term in the world, but the fact of the matter is, what else could he have said that wouldn't have occasioned some sort of problem? If he had said Ebonics, then it would have sounded like he was associating Obama with the ghetto. If he had said African-American Vernacular English, which is what people at the Linguistic Society of America conference call it, it would have been like saying something in Hebrew because nobody knows that term outside of academia. If he had called it Black English, then we would have had even more of the op-ed saying that there's no such thing as Black English. And so he was really kind of caught. And, of course, he's right that Obama can speak without Black English when he wants to.
It seems to me there's a number of dimensions. One of them is the linguistic thing. What words, and what about these expressive conventions that we have that forbid the use of certain kinds of words? And, and I really want to talk about that because I object in the most strenuous terms to this kind of political correctness policing of the language that would forbid the use of the word Negro. There's nothing wrong with that word, in my opinion. And I hold that position really quite strongly because I frankly think it's a superior designation for Americans of African descent, and especially those of us who descend from slavery, because it has a profound historical resonance. There's nothing wrong with that word.
No.
Black, African American, I think you could criticize both of those designations as ways of referring to this population subgroup, although they've become popular.
Mm-hmm.
But where do people get off trying to sanitize the language? And then there's the point that this is all superficial. This is not real moral argument or real public fretting about the serious problems of race in the country.
No.
This is about policing expressive conventions, not about substantively engaging the issue of race. Thirdly, there's the fact that Obama is a racially ambiguous figure. Mm-hmm. His mother is white and his father is black, African immigrant, mm-hmm. and it's in his very DNA. That's what he told us. Mm-hmm. The fact that America is a complex society and that we're made up of many different strands and that those strands can be woven together in a compatible manner was the essence of his campaign. His light-skinnedness and his ability to code switch and move easily and so as not to make white people feel threatened or uncomfortable with himself is at the center of his being.
Of course.
So to point out the obvious fact of Obama's racial ambiguity as being perhaps an asset to him getting elected in this country becomes mm-hmm. unacceptable. That's a kind of, I don't know, madness. It seems to me a kind of collective stupidity that we can't actually talk about the real things in front of us. Instead, we have to do these kinds of dances in which we all try to get, you know, to the right side of some line about political correctness, and I'm tired of it.
Yeah, it's wearying. Often we try to discuss these things as if it was quantum physics with binary alternations, and we pretend that there's no such thing as in-between or hybridicity. But there's also another aspect of this which I find endlessly interesting. There's a book in this that somebody who is not me hopefully will write someday, which is that because of the sort of ideology that you're talking about, when Harry Reid, quote-unquote old white man, says that Barack Obama does not speak Negro English, a response that one is to have, this is like a metric of being a certain kind of informed American now, your response is to say, oh, does he mean all black people speak black English? And of course, one, he didn't say that. And two, there's a subtext in that that it would be wrong if all black people did speak black English, because there's a sense that this Negro English is a collection of mistakes or that it's a badge of shame. And unfortunately, the fact is, well, fortunately, it isn't true. Black English is as coherent in all of its structures as standard English. It's just different. If a Martian came down and wanted to transcribe what English was and happened to land next to a ghetto black guy from Baltimore and took down what he said instead of what, you know, I'm picking somebody at random, George Stephanopoulos said, they would find that the grammar they were taking down was every bit as nuanced and complicated. We have a social evaluation of black English that means that the minute that this person mentions Negro English and our black president in the same breath, many people's antennas go up as if there's been some sort of insult, when really there's nothing wrong with black English. People can often speak both of them, and even the poorest, most disadvantaged person who cannot switch into standard English at all because of lack of access to education, what they're speaking is every bit as much a mental marvel in the sense of complexity as at the Santa Fe Institute that you're visiting right now, every bit as much a mental marvel as Hungarian or Korean. Unfortunately, that sort of thing rarely seems to get beyond the world of academia, but there seems to be this shame about what is one of the hallmarks of being a black American person. And so to me, there's just a kind of a sadness about it.
Yeah. Let's pursue this issue a bit about the actual complexity of the language that's spoken, mm-hmm. the version of English that's spoken. And I don't just mean grammatical, you know, like different use of verb forms, to be or whatever, but mm-hmm. but I mean the intonation and the way that words are pronounced and so on, because, mm-hmm. I'm no linguist, but there's very clear evidence in the social science literature that listeners to recordings of people whom they can't see mm-hmm. Are able with fairly high degree of accuracy to identify the race of the speaker. I'm
very
talking about
high,
black
yeah.
and white hearers.
Exactly.
Are
yeah.
able... There's this. We can post this paper on the Blogging Head. Link to this paper on the Blogging Head website. There's a recent study by the economist at the University of Chicago, Jeffrey Groger,
yeah.
who has data of exactly this kind. Listeners hear a variety of tapes, and then they're asked questions about the speaker, asked to identify the gender, which of course they can do 98% of the time, mm-hmm. and they're asked to identify the race, which amazingly they can also do over 90% of the time.
Right.
Correctly identify the race of an arbitrary voice that they're hearing on a tape recording. So there mm-hmm. is something distinctive about black speech. And I might just add, and I'll finish, that Groger in that same paper shows that African Americans whose speech is especially is identifiable as black with high reliability, earn less money than other African Americans whose speech is not so readily identifiable or who are better at code switching, even when they have similar other characteristics like their education and work experience and so on. So there is such a thing as speaking like a black person, which indeed most black people do, and B, there are consequences to mastering the ability to alter the way in which you speak depending on the audience that you're facing so as not to seem quite so black in your spoken English.
These are
just facts about the world.
These are very real things, and we should underline that what you've mentioned shows, demonstrates, makes clear, explicates that black English and white Southern English are not the same thing. And so there's a tendency some people have to think that it is a sign of being informed, that it's a sign of resisting stereotyping, to think that what you're hearing black people do is sound the way Blanche DuBois or Bill Clinton in some of his moods can sound. And the only reason we perceive it as different is because of the skin color. That's plausible. It's good to check yourself and suppose that that might be true, but it isn't true. There really is a such thing, and it's a combination of vowel patterns and intonations, not to mention some grammatical constructions that are used much, much more, if only exclusively, by black speakers rather than even poor Southern white speakers. And so, yeah, that's there, and the fact of the matter is that I can be all scientific and objective about it, but it's true that we have evaluations about those things. And it has been shown, not only by this recent paper, but in a couple of linguistics papers. I think, for example, of John Ball, who is now at the University of Washington.
Washington University in St. Louis. I know John.
If you know John, yeah, and you also usefully corrected me on what I just called where he works.
Right.
And there's a paradigm called econolinguistics that I know that he was beginning to try to spearhead back in the late 90s. Can't believe how long ago that was. But what he was showing was that the more, to the degree that you do control this sound system and these grammatical features, and by control I mean use, you are less likely to be doing very well in life, such that if one wants to do better in life, most likely it's better to be able to switch into a different mode. Now, there's a cause and effect
issue.
You know,
excuse me, John, we should just post a link to one of John's papers.
We should.
You can.
Logging Heads.
Recommend one, yeah.
Yeah, I'll give you guys where to look for that.
Okay, so you were saying.
Yeah, but yeah, that's true. And the question is it so much that a person's speech means that someone listens to them on the phone and doesn't give them a job? Or is it also that a person's speech reflects where they are in life, culturally, what they had sought to do in life, etc.? I mean, the cause and effect issues here are subtle, but certainly it is true that a certain way of speaking is less associated with being in a boardroom or making a whole lot of money, unless maybe, for example, you're a rap producer or an athlete. And these things need to be thought about.
No, and definitely less associated with being, you know, a smart person in the seminar room.
Oh.
I mean, that's what we do.
Yeah.
We're academics. We give lectures, we give seminars, and teach classes. And you can speak for yourself. I know that I'm consciously managing how I express myself so as to comport with linguistic convention associated with the milieu in which I'm operating. And the flip side of that is if when I'm back on the south side of Chicago and, you know, I'm dealing with my cousin, the electrician, or, you know, my cousin who runs a dry cleaning business or whatever it might be, I'm again quite sure that the English that I'm speaking is closer to the vernacular of my childhood and growing up on the south side and the language that's spoken by my working class relatives than it is to the language that I adopt in the seminar room or, for that matter, for the Blogging Heads listenership. So, you know, this, again, these are just facts about the world. And frankly, I don't regard them as in any way indicative of racism. I mean, I don't regard the idea that a person would form a judgment about another person based in part on the way in which they speak the language as being intrinsically racist. Quite the contrary, I think there's no escaping our using what clues and cues we get in social interaction to form judgments about people. That's the way I think social cognition works. I think we've evolved as a species to read the signs and to take on board subtle stimuli and of this sort in order to form judgments about who we're interacting with. So in some sense, I mean, all of this is to be expected.
Oh, yeah. Dialect discrimination, the way I would put it,
all right,
is human. And so, yes, there's dialect discrimination against what I call the black scent. It is very difficult to sound smart in the rocket scientist sense if you have a black scent. But then that's also true of Southern white. It would be very hard to be taken seriously doing a physics paper in a drawl. People could get used to it. You can put a certain kind of glasses on.
But there's a dissonance. It creates a little conflict inside the mind that has to be overcome.
But people are doing the same sorts of things in India, in Africa, everywhere else. It's just the nature of being human. And the fact of the matter is that there's no escaping this sort of thing. And with black English, it's interesting because, especially these days, it's double-edged. And so on the one hand, black English is not associated with higher-level intelligence. You might be sharp. You might, quote-unquote, have smarts in that sense, but not in terms of figuring out how the planets move, not in terms of really higher thought. On the other hand, we associate black English and its sound with honesty, with vernacular warmth. It's thought of as sexy, and now that hip-hop is America's favorite music, it's the dialect of the music that people, especially people of a certain age, which is lower than both of ours, live to. And so there are two things about black English. Like, for example, yes, Barack Obama does not speak Negro dialect when he doesn't want to, and that had a lot to do with getting him elected, but I think it had an equal amount of getting him elected, that he can use it when he wants to. Nothing thrilled black audiences more than the preacherly cadence, and I think that with young whites, that had a resonance as well. I honestly believe that if he could only speak in, quote-unquote, the white way, he might not be president.
That's a good point, John. I can even remember certain points during the campaign. I can't now name them, but I vividly recall at the time saying, what did he just do? You know, because he was speaking somewhere, okay? Maybe it was Georgia, maybe it was North Carolina. Again, I don't remember the specific venue. And he, in the middle of his, you know, white-oriented, normal discourse, you know, he switched. And he let a few lines come out in, as it were, black speak. And as you say, the black audience was really quite thrilled. And I thought, you know, this guy is communicating on many levels here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's no way for us to test your theory as to what would have happened if he hadn't. But I think you could be right that if he had only been able to speak, as it were, without a Negro accent, he might have been less successful with winning over the confidence of the African-American voters who, of course, supported him in such overwhelming numbers.
And I can't help giggling when you say Negro, because even to me, the word is kind of striking. It just sounds so antique, but it's not insulting. You know what it
also... John, I just want to make one other point before we leave the language thing, which is one of the reasons we don't associate a Negro dialect with high-level physics or, you know, playing in the symphony orchestra or something like that is that the Negroes, like myself, who might rise to some degree of prominence in whatever the field is, will already have adopted and internalized the idea that we shouldn't be speaking black. You know, in other words, if, you know, take a guy like Tavis Smiley. Okay?
Oh, that's perfect.
Now, Tavis, I don't know if he's doing it on purpose or not, but he definitely has a very discernible Negro, almost Southern. For a long time, I thought Tavis was from the South. Then I learned that he was from Indiana, which is not quite the South.
Mm-hmm.
But in any case, you take a guy like Tavis Smiley. Now, part of his kind of persona and definition as a high-level, you know, PBS entrepreneurial journalist who's doing all this kind of stuff is that he's still going to talk like a black person.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's very discernible, and it may well be a conscious choice on his part. If our physicists and our PhD economists who are professors at Ivy League universities and our people who hold down fellowships at big-time New York City think tanks and all the rest of us were to self-consciously determine that we weren't going to tailor our speech in the least in order to come across as an acceptable Negro, but we were just going to talk every bit as black as we might be given to, and I can't even talk that way anymore, you know, because I'm so scripted here. But if we were to do that, I think we would undermine the stereotype that a Negro dialect is associated necessarily with, I don't know, mediocrity or, you know, something like that.
And you know who actually goes a long way towards helping that is somebody we've talked about Cornel West is somebody who...
Oh, yeah, he's another example. You're right.
Rather self-consciously, you know, sticks in that black scent mode. It's part of his persona. And yet, he'll be talking about Paul Tillich and Nietzsche. And so I think that's healthy in a way, because he shows that you can be, we might say, down and also erudite. But Smiley is interesting. I don't think that it's self-conscious on his part. Mm-hmm. Smiley has had problems with being considered, quote-unquote, too black on NPR. And what that meant was that there's a certain range of topics that really interest him, and then there's a range of topics that really don't. You wouldn't hear him on Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, or something like that. Yeah. To him, I think those are quote-unquote white shows. And I think that his accent, his black scent, reflects that he has a hard left, black-oriented, politically informed view of how things are supposed to go. I once saw a poster of Tavis Smiley when I think NPR was trying to shore him up for the last time before the conflict arose, where they were showing him, it must have been a very long photo session, and they were trying to make him look kind of whimsical and kind of apple pie, and he was striking some sort of pose, and it was supposed to look like on one day he might be interested in Jesse Jackson, and on another day he might be interested in the mating habits of praying mantises or something like that. And I remember thinking, no, he doesn't care about praying mantises, and he doesn't care about Greek. Right. They're trying to make him look like it. He has a certain range of interests, and God love him for it. His black scent, I think, reflects that. If he didn't have the black scent, then he would be interested in a wider range of things, and he would have a different career. I think he likes the career that he does have.
Well, but you know, what's successful. I mean, you know,
what's interesting is this. Did you hear about Rod Blagojevich talking about how he's blacker?
Yeah, I heard it. And then he said it was a stupid statement.
But he meant what he said, and I think part of that is because this whole issue of Negro dialect, and also what we might call Negro comportment and Negro body language, is something that has a certain positive value even in mainstream culture in America at this point, such that white people put themselves down for being too white.
But
no
I thought,
one would have said that before.
I thought Blagojevich was making a different point. And, you know, now I'm in dangerous territory because I'm going to be defending Rod Blagojevich. I thought he was saying, I came up hard, and I know a lot about what it's like to be black in a big city in America, because I came up hard. We didn't have a whole lot of money. The neighborhood we lived in, there were a lot of struggling people, and if you're talking about being black, I'm probably blacker than Barack Obama. This is what Blagojevich said, meaning I have a closer personal
poverty
experience of the aspects of life that are really causing a lot of black people to catch hell in this country, because I've seen them firsthand. I grew up in a five-room apartment.
Brawling, right.
You know, whatever it might be, okay? So in the neighborhood that I grew up in, all kinds of stuff was going on. And, you know, so when you talk to me about inner city issues or urban, you know, black, whatever, I know what you're talking about because I've been there a lot closer than somebody like, say, a guy that, you know, grew up in Hawaii.
Right.
And et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, that's a class statement, really. Mm-hmm. I mean, it uses a racial idiom, but the real content of what he's saying is I'm much more of a regular person than this elitist who's your president.
And, you know, it's really...
Now, that may be right or wrong, but there's nothing offensive about it.
No, I didn't find it offensive at all. I found it anthropologically interesting because we're at such a fascinating tipping point here in... Yeah, the history books, 2005 to 2015 is going to be a very fascinating period. Because what he's saying is that black, on some level, is poor and struggling and living just enough for the city.
Yeah, that is what he's saying.
A lot of people would perfectly well agree with that, and if it were 1960, I would agree with it too. Obviously, the definition has to stretch at the point that we're in now. So I'm not offended by what he's saying. We all know exactly what he means. But that's getting as antique as I think African-American is. You know, that term, I think, is on the ropes, because now there's so many
African-Americans.
and not just the white ones, which is a whole different thing, but you can't look a Nigerian immigrant in the face and tell him that you're more African-American than he is when you grew up in Cleveland. And I think that's becoming perfectly clear.
We're playing with words now, in a way, because there's a very different experience that lies behind being a person perhaps from the upper strata of your Ghanaian society who immigrates to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And being somebody who's a descendant from people who had been enslaved in this country and is still, you know, dealing with the consequence. Those are not the same social phenomena.
Mm-mm.
So the fact that you would want to have different words to refer to them is perfectly normal. And if you would allow your language, the use of African-American, to elide the distinction, You would just be, willfully ignorant of the actual structure of your society, right?
Yeah.
So, for example, Barack Obama's blackness, okay? His mother is white, his father, Kenyan, okay? Now, don't get me wrong. I don't have an argument with anybody about, is he really black, quote unquote. What I want to note is that that background is not representative of the people who descended from slaves in the country.
No,
that's just a statement of fact. Now, it may be irrelevant that his ancestry is not the same or the experience that lies behind it as that of millions of people who are, in this country who call themselves black and who are descended from slaves. That may be more or less irrelevant, but it's certainly a legitimate distinction to draw, and the capacity to draw the distinction is undermined by this term African American.
I mean, I think really talk about the history.
Let me just, we have our first black president, but we do not have our first president who descended from slaves who were held in captivity in this country.
So
what has not happened is that a descendant of the persons enslaved in this country has ascended to the highest office in the land. That hasn't happened.
No.
Okay? I don't think Chris Matthews recognizes that.
No. I mean, and by the time that does happen, i.e. that a descendant of African slaves brought to the United States, who probably would be darker complected, and who probably would be someone who has a black scent even when they're speaking in their most formal way, by the time that kind of person becomes president, I don't think we're going to care very much anymore. Certainly Obama is a transitional figure. You could have predicted that it would be somebody lighter, that it would be somebody very bi-dialectal, and that it would be somebody who was African-American only in a technical sense. The idea that we're sitting here in 2009 and 10 talking about that particular man as black in the same sense as Cedric the Entertainer and Condoleezza Rice and whoever else is going to seem an absurdity in not too much time. We are caught up in our times that is the way we have to categorize the person. But that's the way it was going to be anyway. Anybody who expected that the first black president was going to be as dark as J.C. Watts or was going to talk like Jesse Jackson Jr. or was going to be a descendant of slaves here, you know, that would be a kind of social historical transition much less gradual than I think it ever happens. But yeah, it's interesting stuff.
Well, I want to know your take on this moral crusade against quote unquote offensive speech. Okay, so Harry Reid. So he said, you know, what he now refers to as his stupid remarks. I don't see anything stupid about them. What he said, it seemed to me, was true. And I can't imagine that Democrats were not asking themselves, if we get behind this black guy, is the country going to elect him? They had to be asking themselves that kind of a question.
Of course.
Before they decided to throw their weight behind somebody. They had to consider, how will the country read all of the traits and features of this candidate as we come forward, the same way you would do with anybody else. They wouldn't have been doing due diligence if they hadn't asked these questions. So now I turn on my television or I pick up my newspaper and I'm seeing all these people who are upset, African Americans and others. Now the Republicans, of course, are upset for that. You know, the Michael Steeles are upset for partisan reasons, but who are saying, "I'm offended. I'm offended." And it's like, you know, his use of the archaic term "Negro" is offensive to people. And I'm, you know, I want to know what you think about people being having such a hair trigger sensibility and being prepared to throw a fit in public and be offended by people who are obviously not intending to give any offense and who are simply stating things that are more or less true.
All right, Glenn, I want to throw a question back at you about, in relation to that. Because we both know that there's a certain kind of person who enjoys taking offense. You know, there's a recreation to it.
Yeah.
But I'm trying to check myself on this one, and I'm angry at myself for not being able to come to a decision. There's the comparison that people are making between this and what Trent Lott said when he was Senate Majority Leader at a celebration for Strom Thurmond, when he jokingly said that maybe it wouldn't have been so bad if old Strom had become president. And of course, old Strom, back in the day, had been an ardent and explicit segregationist.
Yes, he had. Dixiecrat.
I remember when that one broke, and this was earlier in my, whatever you want to call it, race punditry career, I thought that Trent Lott needed to step down. And to this day, I'm still repulsed by the idea of somebody standing up and making light of the idea of a segregationist becoming president, because what it meant, I don't think that Trent Lott is running around shooting black people in cold blood, and I don't know whether he's a racist, but it meant that he didn't think that the Civil Rights Revolution was any big, big deal. You know, once that stuff is over, you can make this little joke at a party. And so I thought he should step down, but nowadays I look back on that, and I think to myself, I remember at that time, that was one of the first things that I did that made people realize that I am not the Republican right-winger that people thought. But now I look back and I think, shouldn't I maybe have just said, this is one more example of someone saying something graceless, but life will go on, racism is in recession, Trent Lott is old, getting rid of this person isn't going to have anything to do with legislation. Shouldn't I have just let it go? Because I'm inclined to think that if it happened now, I might. Or was there a difference between the two things? What do you think about that?
I'm really glad you raised that. I think there's a difference between Harry Reid and Trent Lott. Harry Reid used the wrong words. Trent Lott had the wrong idea. The words that Trent Lott used to express his idea were not in and of themselves objectionable. He didn't say nigger or negro or any such thing.
Right.
But the content of what he said was that you were a Dixiecrat, you were for segregation, you ran for president, we voted for you, and we wish you had won.
Mm-hmm.
The country would have been better off if you had won.
Now.
There was nothing wrong
right.
with being a Dixiecrat. That's what he was saying.
Right.
Now, of course, I do think there was something wrong with being a Dixiecrat. I think that. And I think the country would have been worse off, not better off, mm-hmm. if the civil rights movement had been delayed a decade or two mm-hmm. by the success of
Congressman.
You know, so no doubt about that. Now, on the other hand, though, many people agree with Trent Lott, and those people are Americans too.
Mm-hmm.
After all, they sent from South Carolina, they sent Strom Thurmond back to the Senate until he was a gazillion years old.
Mm-hmm.
They voted for him. These are mm-hmm. Americans. Okay,
mm-hmm.
So there are, in fact, a large number of people who, when they look at the legacy of a Strom Thurmond career, don't see anything to apologize about there and think that Strom Thurmond was fighting the good fight. Now, here's what I want to say. Those people don't get to express that view? That's a minority view that I don't share. Is the holding of that view ipso facto morally offensive?
And therefore, are you saying that
I'm saying you answer a person's argument with another argument. You don't call them a name.
Right.
Okay? And what I'm saying is, if Trent Lott's admiring of the career of Strom Thurmond is an offense,
mm-hmm.
then the proper response is not that Trent Lott said the thing. The proper response is to say exactly what the nature of the offense is. And you're not just talking to Trent Lott when you say that. You're also talking to the people who kept voting Strom Thurmond back into the United States Senate.
Okay.
Year after year after year. Let me put it another way. I might not like everything that Jesse Jackson says,
mm-hmm.
okay? But to the extent that a Jesse Jackson or a Jesse Jackson Jr. represents the people on the south side of Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
My argument is with them. Okay? You may not like everything that Jeremiah Wright says. Okay? But to the extent that Barack Obama is tainted by Jeremiah Wright's sermons, your argument is with the people on the south side of Chicago because mm-hmm. they ate it up and they came in the thousands to his church. This is what I'm saying. I'm mm-hmm. just trying to make an analogy, but what I'm saying is, you know, not, you know, we are a country in which we don't have a human unanimity of opinion about a lot of these things. And in fact, some, you know, take this Martin Luther King holiday thing. Again. I think that a senator ought to have voted for federal legislation that would have created a holiday honoring Martin Luther King as a mm-hmm. way of showing deference and respect to
mm-hmm.
the sensibilities and the aspirations of an important part of the population of this country
mm-hmm.
and of honoring the accomplishments, the historic accomplishments of Martin Luther King in terms of bringing our country to a better place. That's what I think. Okay? Now, Martin Luther King was a complicated and controversial historical figure. And I don't doubt that there are many constituencies in this country who would have had an ambivalence. Now, my view is they needed to suck it up, get used to it. We're going to have a King Day, and 50 years or 100 years from now, the meaning of that day will be something entirely different, and we won't remember all of this squabble. But it's, of course, a part of democratic politics that if the country is complicated in the views held by its people, then the political discourse is going to reflect that complexity and reflect the texture of those disagreements, even over something like so this kind of excommunicating people for not holding my view, for daring to have a thought. This is the thing that I'm finding problematic. So anyway, what am I saying about Trent Lott? I guess what I'm saying is...
Should he have had to step down?
Yeah.
That's the question. So you say that because of the particular nature of that minority view, he should not have been in a position of power. I'm having trouble as the years go by in justifying that on a level other than a visceral one, that we were supposed to punish him in some way. But my question is, what did that do for or against the fate of, for example, the people on the south side of Chicago, or in terms of the general position of black people within this country? Did it have any effect, or did it just make us all feel kind of good for showing that most of us are with the program? I'm just trying for some consistency here.
It had no effect on the substantive issues as far as I can tell. Trent Lott was not the majority leader after he stepped down, but then another Republican was the majority leader when the Republicans were in the majority in the Senate, and I don't think the legislative agenda of the United States Congress was affected one whit by Trent Lott's troubles. So that's kind of what I mean by how empty is this, morality of expressive convention, where what we do is we police the words, but we don't address ourselves to substantive morality of institutions and social practices, like incarcerating a million African-American men on a given day in this country, where we're basically doing social policy for the poor with our punitive institutions of courts and the police. We're treating the consequences of failed schools and a lack of investment in our cities and the continuing economic subordination of a substantial minority of our population and our failure to step up and be sufficiently committed and inventive to develop social programs that mitigate these deep structural inequalities that have a racial aspect. We don't deal with that. We don't talk about that. Instead, we talk about the words that people are using.
I think that there should be a year moratorium on any kerfuffles or brouhahas about the way anybody, white or black or something else, put things. It would be nice to have 365 days go by where the news organizations and everybody else were forbidden to make a big deal over anything anyone said, and just to watch how life would go on and to watch what would change and what wouldn't change, and maybe to get the American public and American tastemakers and opinion makers used to dealing with substance in the way that you're talking about, because gosh, we waste an awful lot of time with this sort of thing. Interesting. Remember Kramer, Michael Richards, on Seinfeld.
Yeah, nigger.
He says nigger, and there's all of this news, and people like you and me get to write about it and talk about it, and he apologizes to Al Sharpton, and Jerry Seinfeld gets trotted out to pretend that he gives a damn about it. All of that was in the news for what I remember was a good 3 weeks. Now, rather recently, Curb Your Enthusiasm on HBO did their wonderful final season episode where they did a Seinfeld reunion, and it was delightful. And one of the aspects of the Seinfeld reunion was Michael Richards, playing himself in this thing, doing the reunion, making fun of the whole nigger episode, and not in a disrespectful way, but the idea was that now, 3 years later, well, we can joke about that.
It's fodder. Yeah, it's fodder.
Yeah, and
for
it just
comedian.
Made me think, if we can laugh about it now, and it's really, it's like 10 minutes later, I remember it all very well. If we can laugh at it now, why was it so important then, and what did we learn? None of that should have even been discussed.
It's a very good point, John. I think Stephen Colbert has kind of picked up on this. Did you see the little thing that he did on Negro? He says, now that the president has blessed Harry Reid and said there's not a racist bone in his body or whatever.
Yeah.
That it's okay, or maybe it was the attorney general who said there's not a racist bone in his body. But in any case, now that high-level African-American Democrats have said that Harry Reid is okay, it's safe for the rest of us to use the word Negro. This is Colbert. And then he says, come on, I say knee, you say grow. Okay? And he gets a call-response thing going with the audience on Negro. It's as funny as it could possibly be. But like you, like you say, the very fact that it becomes fodder for this kind of comic, you know, performance shows that it really couldn't have been all that important. In the
it shows
place.
That there's a performative aspect to a great deal of what passes for racial opinion. And it gets worse every year, it seems to me. We are saying lines, and we are fulfilling parts rather than actually dealing with substantive issues. And as these things keep going by, and I find myself looking back 6 months later at, you know, Colbert making jokes about something or Curb Your Enthusiasm, or even myself, and I look at the aging files on my computer where I pitched in on something, which really didn't matter in any genuine way at all, it really makes me think, is there possibly another way, or is this just the nature of being human, for part of what we profess to be offended about to be more about performing something rather than genuinely feeling it? And it scares me sometimes. It really does.
Yeah.
But here we are.
So, you're a New Yorker.
I am at this
basically.
Point.
Mm-hmm. I know you live in New Jersey, but, you know, just
we don't talk about that.
All right. You're a New Yorker. Now, an African-American, clean and articulate, young, former congressman.
I knew you weren't referring to me as clean.
Is trying to run for the senator, talking about it, thinking about it, is getting in the newspapers, it got everybody upset. Now, I don't understand. In a progressive state, in a progressive media center, why isn't a black senator from New York every bit as exciting as a black president of the United States? And why isn't Harold Ford got the editorial board at the New York Times salivating at the prospect that they will be able to proudly point to an African-American senator from that state should Ford enter, win the primary, and then go on to win the general election? Instead, what I'm reading and the vibes that I'm getting is that the progressive Democrats in New York State are going to get behind this woman, Gillibrand, who is a relatively conservative Democrat until just day before yesterday, representing a conservative upstate district in New York.
This is interesting.
And not behind the black candidate.
Well,
I don't get it. I thought we were racially progressive. I thought having black people in high office is the thing we want to do. And since Roland Barris is probably not going to be serving very long, we don't have... after Barris steps down, any blacks in the Senate, it would seem to me that New Yorkers owe the country to get behind Harold Ford's candidacy, and that the New York Times editorial board ought to stop being ambivalent and endorse an African American for the Senate in New York.
Well,
what do you think about that?
Oh, well, I think he's. I was thinking about him last night. He's interesting. Good person. And the reason for what you're talking about, I was tossing this around. One, he doesn't happen to have a certain stage presence. Maybe they can train him into it.
But carpetbagger.
He doesn't have that magic. Two, carpetbagger. Three, kind of a funny dynastic history, and that would chase him.
You mean his
and
father?
I mean, some of that stuff that went on down there. And also, he in his heart of hearts is pro-life, and he's made this kind of switch because he wants to play to the country at large and to a larger slice of the party. But I think that tends to worry people who dig in him a little bit. But I think we're certainly going to see more of him. He'll have some training, and he'll do some explaining. And, you know, frankly, if he gets off some good line that people remember and that gets passed around on YouTube, then this same gene that we have for getting upset about what people say or pretending to be might make him a hero just because he says something well at some point. So we'll see what happens.
All right.
But, yeah, he's an interesting guy. Very interesting guy.
Yeah.
So, Glenn, we've hit that kind of 45-minute
mark. All right, yeah, let's call it a day. We've talked about the Harry Reid issue, and I think that's enough for one conversation.
Well, this was a fun one.
Yeah, there's much else to discuss. We'll get back together again soon, I trust.
Very good. We definitely will.
All right, well, be well from Santa Fe, New Mexico. I'm looking at the mountains out the window right now. It's just gorgeous.
Well, here I am in New York, and my view isn't as good, but I wish you well.
Take care, John.
Bye.